and simultaneously he is engaged into the dialogue and the talks with the military that they should take him back into the power. They should give him to another opportunity to serve the country. And simultaneously, he is also the pawn and the puppet of the international establishment, because there are a lot of gossips and there are a lot of the hair and saying that Imran Khan, that currently right now the country who is facing such kind of the severe challenges at this time, he is not colliding with the current government, but actually he is colliding with the state and an institution of the Pakistan. He is trying to make an impression that there is a clash of the institution, and simultaneously he wants to drive the country into the very, very unprecedented and very violent situation that is, of course, the civil war.
Last but not least, the country is in dire economic straits with soaring inflation and depleting foreign reserves. So what do you think is the panacea for Pakistan's unending economic woes?
I think the Pakistan's current economic solution is only into the stable political situation. If the country situation would be stable and it will be move on, I think that the country would like to back on their reserves and all those the economic challenges which the country is facing. And unfortunately, this is exactly the country is facing, because in the last 3 years, when Imran Khan was as the prime minister, there was the mega embezzlements and there was the huge losses at the diplomatic front, economic front, and all even the strategical partner of Pakistan, in which Pakistan faced huge losses. And this is the credit goes to Imran Khan, which he is trying to now prove and proving to the people of the Pakistan that I am your well-wisher and I am trying to take this country back from all these challenges. So I think that the only economic solution and the stability is possible, and the country will be have the stable political transition, and it should go like this.
There you have it, Mr. Sumbal, political analyst from Islamabad. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
CJ Werleman, journalist and columnist, says in terms of size and orderliness, Imran Khan's so-called long march is something he has not seen in modern political history. Social media activist Hassan Mafi remarks that the U.S. is trying to do to Imran Khan what it did to Lula in Brazil, describing him as a threat to U.S. hegemony in the region. Javeria Siddiqui, wife of slain Pakistani journalist and Imran Khan's aide Arshad Sharif, demands justice for him and says he received death threats before he left the country.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Himalayan region of Kashmir is known for its abundant water resources, with many lakes, rivers and glaciers. But this water has also been a source of conflict between strange neighbours, India and Pakistan, while at the same time putting the local environment and indigenous communities at the risk in the name of development. At least 7 new hydropower dams are being constructed in the region's Kishtwar district, known for its dense forests, sparking concerns amongst environmentalists, geologists and local people who depend on the forest for their survival.
Indian authorities are currently in the process of building 7 new hydropower dams in Kishtwar, a district in Jammu and Kashmir state endowed with dense forests of deodar, pine and fir. The dams aim to generate around 5,190 megawatts of hydroelectricity, according to local officials, but they are also likely to imperil the lives of more than 20,000 local inhabitants, predominantly members of indigenous communities who depend on the forest for sustenance and survival. The BJP government in New Delhi approved the controversial dam projects as part of its aggressive push to switch from coal to renewable energy. But environmentalists and geologists fear it will destroy the local ecosystem, endanger the lives of nomadic and farming communities, and impact the region's overall water security. The ambitious project would also see vast tracts of forest land wiped off and fertile agricultural land submerged, displacing over 20,000 people. The dams will come up on the Chenab River, one of the most complex river basins of the world, that flows into Kishtwar from the northern Indian state of Himachal Pradesh before it reaches Pakistan. So the ripple effect of this project, experts believe, will be felt beyond Kashmir, exacerbating the long-running water conflict in the region.
More than 3,300 dams have been constructed across India since the partition in 1947, displacing millions of people and fueling discontent. In particular, dams in the contested Kashmir region have long risked a major water war between India and Pakistan as they disrupt the flow of the Chenab River. In Jammu and Kashmir and nearby Himachal Pradesh together, more than two dozen hydropower projects have been planned on the river and its tributaries, including Chenab Valley, known as an active seismic zone with a history of earthquakes.
The under-construction dams in Jammu and Kashmir are likely to disrupt the ecological balance, displace people, affect marine life in the Chenab River, cause the loss of forest land, as well as heighten risks of earthquakes, considering the region's high seismicity, according to experts. One such hydropower project has already displaced thousands of people from multiple villages in Kishtwar, and the first storage project on Chenab River's largest tributary in the region is likely to submerge nearly a dozen villages and displace hundreds of families. The new dam construction also risks inflaming water politics between India and Pakistan. The two countries had in 1960 signed the Indus Water Treaty to share the waters of cross-border rivers. The treaty allowed India to build dams on rivers, including the Chenab, so long as they did not affect the flow of water to Pakistan. However, Pakistan has repeatedly accused India of causing a water crisis in the country through the construction of dams. Pakistan, for its part, has also been working on multiple dam projects on its side. Experts fear the dramatic developments following the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019 have heightened the risks of a major water conflict between the two neighbors, with India hastening the construction of dams.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Jahangir Mohammed, the Director of Center for Muslims Affairs from Manchester. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Mohammed. Now, India is building more than half a dozen hydropower dams in Indian-administered Kashmir's Kishtwar district. So what could be its possible repercussions on the local communities?
So I think the first thing to note is that Kashmir is a disputed region under international law, and the Kashmiris have a right to self-determination. Unfortunately, India annexed and made Kashmir forcibly part of India in 2019. So the dams and the rivers should really be part of the dispute settlement for the Kashmiri people. But of course, these dams will cause immense problems for the local communities due to the potential for earthquakes and flooding in the area.
Mr. Mohammed, the Chenab Valley is considered an active seismic zone with a history of earthquakes. Now, do you think this ambitious project, approved by the BJP government in New Delhi, puts the lives of people at risk?
Yes, it does. Any kind of building, particularly as one of the dams is, some of the dams are in the Chenab Valley region, which is a seismic 4 zone, and in terms of earthquakes, and there is an expected earthquake sometime soon, seismologists have been predicting. So any kind of building along the fault line will have a major impact on the area and could trigger an earthquake. And if an earthquake does happen, then the lakes around it may also flood. So as well as an earthquake, you may get flooding, which will be catastrophic for the people of the valley, and which will kill thousands of people and destroy their homes. So I think what India is doing is reckless, and it is not considering the Kashmiris' interests. It's thinking of its own economic interests. And of course, there is the issue of the quality of build of dams, which in India, Pakistan and Bangladesh have not been great, and which also contribute to flooding.
Mr. Mohammed, in 1960, India and Pakistan signed the Indus Water Treaty to share the waters of cross-border rivers, including Chenab. Now, the question is, has India's dam activity violated the terms of the deal?
Yes, potentially it has, because the Indus Treaty was negotiated between Pakistan and India by the World Bank, and it's a legitimate treaty. Three of the rivers on the eastern side are supposed to be under Indian control, and three, including the Chenab, are supposed to be under the control of Pakistan. And therefore, by carrying out activity in the three rivers that are supposed to be under the control of Pakistan, they are potentially violating the agreement although they have some rights to use the water. This has to be part of the settlement. Of course, no settlement has taken place, so India has already violated not just the treaty, but the rights of the Kashmiri people. And therefore, they've taken the whole region as its own property. And of course, the Hindutva ideology in power in India today considers all of the Indus rivers, and the tributaries around it as part of a historic Indic civilization and not part of Pakistan or anywhere else. So they have an ideological obsession with claiming these rivers as well. They believe it's the birthplace of Hindu civilization.
Last but not least, Mr. Mohammed, dam constructions have throughout the post-partition history of India led to popular mass protests. Now, could you help us understand why?
Well, water is a scarce, an important resource in the area. Kashmir is an area of valleys, and people live in those valleys. So any potential rebuild and development of dams can lead, especially if they're badly constructed, can lead to flooding. And in fact, the recent floods in Pakistan, India did release some water, which has contributed to that flooding in Pakistan this year. So they cause immense damage. India, of course, wants them for hydro and other electrical power. Power shortages are quite common in India and Pakistan. So this is an important resource. But also, water control can be used as a weapon of war. If India controls the Indus River and the tributaries, then basically they control the water supply that Pakistan depends on. 80% of the control of these rivers was given to Pakistan under the treaty, and therefore Pakistan will suffer, but India could either withhold water or release water, causing flooding in Pakistan, in the Kashmir area, and even drought if they stop the water. So this can also be used as a weapon of war, although if they both agree and use it in a spirit of cooperation, it can be used to develop both nations. But until a settlement of the disputed status of Kashmir takes place, the two countries will always be in a state of war, which will cause disruption in Kashmir and also in Pakistan as well.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Mohammed for being on the program. He's the director of Center for Muslims Affairs from Manchester. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Kashmiri multimedia journalist Safina Nabi writes that seven new dams India is constructing in the fragile ecology of Indian-administered Kashmir will carry a high human and environmental cost. Khalid Yaqub Mir, a university researcher, notes that recent floods in the Indian state of Uttarakhand were a wake-up call for dam construction in Kashmir's Chenab Valley, where seven new dams are coming up.
And that was our episode about the ongoing political crisis in Pakistan, made worse by the deteriorating economy as well as the construction of dams in Kashmir at the cost of the environment. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
عليٌ حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala Ahli Baytihi at-Tayyibin at-Tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood. And we are having a discussion with regards to the idea and the fact that the messengers came to this world, they were brought and sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in certain circumstances that the earth and the people of the earth were facing. And amongst those circumstances is what Imam Ali alayhi salam reminds us in the second sermon. And he tells us that these circumstances are what? These are those circumstances whereby the people started to follow the devil. They followed the shaitan, they followed his cause, they followed his path. And as a result of that, they were stomped upon, they were crushed under the hooves and under the feet of these devils, of these enemies of God. These tribulations and these tests, they crushed the people. They couldn't come out of these areas, out of these problems. And therefore he goes on to say that these were people who are in a state of confusion. They were lost. فَهُمْ فِيهَا تَائِهُونَ. They were lost in these tribulations and trials, and they couldn't come out of them. جَاهِلُونَ. They continued to be in a state of ignorance. مَفْتُونُونَ. They were deceived. And they were not living good lives. They realized this and they knew that.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam is creating a picture. He's kind of drawing this this beautiful, or this you can say, not beautiful as such, but you can say the intricate and quite artistic painting about the reality of the society at that time. He's as if he's painting with the most, you can say, the most superb colors, most relevant colors to show us the society at that time, that state of confusion that the people were in. Then he says, "Naumuhum suhud." Their sleep was not sleep. Actually, when they were asleep, they weren't able to sleep well. They didn't have proper sleep. They didn't have rest. They always in a state of worry and confusion. وَكُحْلُهُمْ دُمُوعًا. And their eyes had kohl, but that kohl were their tears. Their tears was their kohl. They were like that. بِأَرْضٍ عَالِمُهَا مُلْجَمْ. In a land where the knowledgeable people were shackled, they couldn't do what they had to do. They couldn't guide the people. They were not even given importance. وَجَاهِلُهَا مُكَرَّمْ. In a land where the ignorant people were given value, they were given position, they were respected. And you can see the exact situation today, that the people of knowledge are not taken seriously. But people who have money, people who have that sheen and that shine, people who, for example, have a good physique, though they can be the most ignorant of people, they are given importance. The celebrities, let's say, I'm not pointing out at all celebrities, there might be some good celebrities. I'm talking about the ones that are not knowledgeable, the ignorant ones. Those who misguide others. Talking about those ones. وَجَاهِلُهَا مُكَرَّمْ. The ignorant ones are given value. This was the circumstance. These were the grounds when the messengers came. You can see how Imam Ali alayhi salam slowly and gradually he takes us into this, you know, journey, showing us live what the situation was at that time. And at those times when the messengers came.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when we look at the world today, and we see that really the same thing is happening, especially for those who are living under oppressive societies, dictatorships, or they are living under a democracy, a flawed democracy, not an unreal democracy, which fools the people. And you know about these democracies today. Even those who call for democracy in the world today are the ones that have the weakest and most wretched forms of democracy. They say democracy, but they don't have democracy in reality. It's like a few rich people that decide what's going to happen in that community. People just are used as pawns whenever they are used for any purpose, let's say. We see that in the society of today, the same thing's happening. People are in the state of ignorance. Look at the majority of the people of the world. They might have information in their heads, but are they knowledgeable? Do they know about the purpose of their life? Do they know about where they are going and who is controlling the affairs? Are they aware about the direction in which the societies are going? Do they care about the oppression that is happening in different parts of the world? Do they really worry about it? You see, these same people in the world, they see with their own eyes that their leaders, they go to attack another country with the excuse that there is a dictator in that country, while these same people are the ones that support dictators in the world. See them. You can see in the Middle East, majority of the dictators are being supported by those very people that find excuses to fight dictators when they want. The people of double standards. But why are these double standards not seen? Why are the people blind? It is because they are thrown into confusion. They are drowning in this state of confusion. They are in need of someone to remove them from that confusion. This was the situation at the time when the messengers and the prophets had came. People in those states, confused, in need of light. And that is when the messengers and the prophets came. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and its purified family. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Sister Rehana Kazemi. She has done Bachelor's of Science in Applied Psychology. She's a researcher in the Hafsa Ilmi of Qom, and her research right now is on best trainers and coaches for students in non-Islamic countries with Islamic perspective. A very warm welcome, sister, and assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much.
Well, sister, today we want to start with an audience question with you. We have audience questions that say the children have recently changed the school. And since they changed the school, the children got into a new school, especially who are in their early teens. And both the children are facing bullying from the seniors of their new school. So how do they deal with this?
That's the common problem after reopening the schools. Whenever the new students came in the madrasas or school, there are the older students make fun and they bully them. And the children get upset, and when they went back to the home, they said, now we don't want to go to the school. That's a very common problem nowadays. And I think, according to my opinion, not only the mother or the family, the school or your madrasa plays a big or major role to stop these things, to making fun others or bullying the children. So first of all, the family have to take the step and go to the school and spoke to the teacher about those children who are making fun of the other children. And also, mother and father need to speak with their children as well, their child, and they need to speak to their children about the moral values.
Okay.
And need to tell them what is the moral value of a good person, of a good student. And teacher also need to tell them that if someone enter into your school and he's a new person,
how to welcome him?
How to welcome? What is the ikhlaq of our Prophet?
What is the values?
What is the value of our Prophet? Or what is the values of Islam? What is the values when a new guest enter into your house?
What are the ethics, actually? What are the behaviors?
Yes, what are the ethics? Because usually, those who make fun of the others mostly take pleasure from these things to annoy others, to annoy other student, and enjoying making others furious. But this is not good. You need to understand, you need to realize to tell children, teacher need to tell the students that this is not a good step. If someone treats you like the same way, would you like this? After this, definitely the child will understand that's not good. If someone will treat to me like the same, I will never ever accept this. Because this is a very delicate and sensitive age. And once, if a child bullied to the other children, mm-hmm. or other boy or other girl, maybe they don't want to come back in the school. And they will put off from the school. Because this is a very sensitive age.
All right.
And often I say, when the foreigner came here, the other students need to take them to a special place.
They need to have some special positions.
Special
positions.
We'll talk position
more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Sister Rehana Kazemi, who's talking about bullying the children. And you said, like, if you as a Muslim mother have a child who is bullying others, you got to talk to him. Your school got to talk to him. It's not only parents who can talk to a child. It's the teachers who play a major role. It's the school itself that plays a major role.
Yes.
It's the parents who play the major role. And it's you have to keep a child in the same box. If you are a victim tomorrow of bullying,
How would you feel like?
Because I think that's one-to-one conversation. If you communicate to your child and the other children as well who are bullying, they need to tell to their parents, teacher need to tell to their parents, and they need to realize what they are doing, what their children are doing, because the Islamic family will never ever allow their children to bully the other children. They need to tell them what is the good akhlaq in their homes. And if you tell your children the good manners and good behaviors in your home, definitely when they come in the school, they are the representative of your family. So they never ever represent your family like the same way. They represent the same way you treat them in the home. They will never ever bully the other children, because the basic education of the child starts from the mother's lap, because the first school of a child is her or his mother's lap.
Okay.
And mother lap is very important. That behavior in your home plays a major role for a child's life. Whenever he goes out, whenever he goes to the school,
yeah,
or in the market or any other place, in the park or plays with the other children, his moral values start from his home. What values he brings from home, definitely he will show in the school, in the park, or on the other places.
All right. So you're saying that it's actually the behavior is triggered somewhere in the family, somewhere in the school.
Yes.
The behaviors a child has faced over there, he could turn into a bullying child. But now what about a child who is a victim himself? How can Muslim parents help his child who is a victim of bullying?
The parents of the victim child should treat them kindly and need to tell them, if it's happened, you need to be patient. He's like your brother.
Act upon patience.
Yes. Act upon patience. Because Islam taught us the brotherhood. And you are in a school, you are in the same class, and you need to act like brothers or sisters. If you are in a girl's school, it happens after, not in the boys' school, in girls' school as well, because nowadays the children are very hyper and they like to make the fun of others. This is the main problem in the non-Islamic countries, not in the Islamic countries, because in the Islamic countries, mostly children have the Islamic values and they do understand what Islam teaches us, how we treat with the other children,
mm-hmm,
how we treat with the class fellows, how we treat with our friends.
Mm-hmm.
So in non-Muslim countries, there is a big issue.
All right.
And the children do not understand, because the mothers are non-Islamic mothers and they do not teach their children the Islamic values.
All right. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Now, listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm with Sister Rehana Ghazvi, and we're discussing about Islamic upbringing. Sister, you talked about bullying of other children. And have you reached a point that a family that practices Islamic values won't ever develop a child, won't ever give out a child who will be bullying others? So it's somewhere in the family, it's somewhere in the school where values are missing. Now, what about the children, the parents who are living in non-Islamic environment? How do they help their children? What kind of things are there they can practice to avoid the child getting into a bullying child, or to avoid the child getting a victim of bullying?
Okay. In the non-Islamic country, I say if the parents see that their child is being bullied, and if they want to stop those who make fun of others from this practice, try not to indicate that you are annoyed, I have lost your temper. For this purpose, ignore those,
okay,
who laugh at you and do not care about what they say. Just ignore that person. If it is not possible for you or for them to overlook them, then take a distance from them and try not to get close to them till such time they continue this work.
All right.
Just try to ignore them. try to stop sitting, especially the teachers try to stop these children. They do not sit together. They do not play together mm-hmm. to stop this bullying.
All right. So you're trying to say that in order to get stopped, this bullying, as a, like if your child is a victim, you can go to the school, talk to the teachers, and even talk to your child yourself, that's make a distance. But what was the very beautiful point that I loved from this discussion was that teach your child that you are brothers and sisters. That was really, really important thing that Islam teaches us, that because you won't see every parent telling their child this thing, because they think that their child is a king or a prince, but the other children are as if they are not living in the society. Yes. But Islam here teaches a very, very beautiful thing, that the thing of brotherhoodness, yes. That you are brothers and sisters. That was really beautiful, that if you could teach your children, it's okay, they are your brothers, it's okay, they're your sisters, and act with patience, overlook this thing, make a distance with them, ignore them for this fact, but, you know, at the same time, forgive them, because yes. forgiving is also something that Islam very, very much emphasizes upon.
I think that's very, like, sensitive age. I just told you in the first program that there are three set of age, like 1 to 7, that when the child is a king.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that he is king and the parents neglect his mistakes.
It means that do not expect something mature from a yes. child.
But you need to, like, figure out the mistakes and tell your child that you are doing wrong thing here and you need to...
correct,
like,
it.
Yes. You need to rectify.
All right.
But this doesn't mean that you ignore your child and ignore his mistakes, because he or she will pick up these things from early age. So just need to realize you are king. You can do everything, but you need to be careful about the mistakes. Do not make the mistakes.
All right. So summing it up, you are trying to say that if you're giving out a child in the society who is bullying others, can be a result of the first 7 years wherein your upbringing was wrong. You considered him a complete king. You neglected his mistakes. Yeah. You did not take care of like what you were supposed to take care of. Expecting him to be a king means to not to expect something very mature from
that
him.
That he can do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much, sister, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. If you have any questions, dear audiences, comments or suggestions, please contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on the social media websites just by searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also listen to our programs on our official website, that's www.parstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Economic divide.
The UK has a new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. He has promised to get things in order, although his tone is reserved in how he can do that, especially given the economic storm that the UK is facing. Will he be able to turn things around, or is it too much to handle for Sunak? Hi, I'm Kavit Ahway. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in this program, first we take a look at Sunak himself. 42 years old, 7 years in politics only, but what is standing out? His estimated fortune, £730 million, or $830 million. Can he connect with the average Brits? Next up, Sunak's economic plans, but not too fast. His economic agenda, somewhat hazy, based on how it's been described. Most likely higher taxes, which he has introduced, and along with that, reduced spending. Big question is, will that be enough? Next up, some of the traits of the UK economy, negative ones, inflation, looking at food, mortgage, and energy, poverty, 22%, and of course, the recession. We'll find out whether Sunak can deal with all of that or not.
After lots of drama, the UK now has a new Prime Minister.
But some mistakes were made. Not born of ill will or bad intentions. Quite the opposite, in fact. But mistakes, nonetheless. And I have been elected as leader of my party and your Prime Minister, in part, to fix them.
The UK's cost of living crisis started in 2021, with essential good prices increasing faster than household revenues. The result was a sharp fall in real incomes, with inflation running at 10% for now, predicted to reach even highs of 20% or more. The UK consumer confidence remains at an all-time low. Consumers face a tighter economic squeeze in 2023 after Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt scrapped tax cuts planned by former Prime Minister Liz Truss. He also scaled back her vast energy support scheme for households.
Social media posts about this topic is pretty evident in terms of all eyes being on Sunak and what he is going to do. At the same time, there are many who are very pessimistic about whether he's able to make sure that the UK economy is not going to actually go through a downfall, not that it hasn't. So, let's take a look at some of the media posts. First up, we took a look at this one from himself, where he said, "I will unite our country, not with words, but with action. I will work day in and day out to deliver for you." Okay, the man himself. The economic cost of Brexit is our next post, where it said, "We're masked by the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine. But 6 years after the UK voted to leave the EU, the Brexit effect has become clear. And in this film, we examine how Brexit hit the UK economy." Our next post, "The war did not destroy the UK economy. Liz Truss didn't destroy the UK economy. Shutting down the economy for months on end and printing £500 billion in quantitative easing during this period destroyed the UK economy. Also, it's a global economic crisis, not just a UK one." Our next post, "Britain has been living beyond its means since about the year 2007. Several other countries, such as the U.S., also live beyond their means. You are right. Final straw in long overdue crisis was printing of billions in currency by many governments to support their economies during COVID." Then, a stark reality. The 6 richest billionaires in the U.K. have as much money as the poorest 13.2 million, with 3 million more who are about to be pushed into poverty. The 6 should pay, not the 16 million. Wealth taxes, not cuts. All right, those were the posts that we picked. Let's introduce our guests for this edition of the Q&A. First up, Niall McRae joins us. He's the officer of the Workers of England Trade Union. Niall McRae, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at the United Kingdom and the rest of the Europe, for that matter, they are facing not a good year. You have inflation worries, the recession fears, and, of course, you have the high energy costs. You have the stimulus that in the case of the UK is set to be over £550 billion, and the UK performing the worst out of the G7 countries. Why is the UK at the bottom of the list there, do you think?
Well, of course, the UK and the European Union is blaming this all on Russia. They're blaming it all on Vladimir Putin and the the conflict in Ukraine. But these inflationary pressures existed long before the Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine. It's got worse since the war in Ukraine started. But that's partly because the EU and the UK have imposed sanctions on Russian oil and gas and other Russian produce, which has exacerbated the problem of inflation. But the inflation problem was already there because of the quantitative easing, because of the vast printing of money for these incredibly profligate COVID measures, such as in the UK, we had this track and trace system, which cost billions of pounds. And then the huge expenditure on the contract with Pfizer and other vaccine manufacturers. The cost of furlough, you know, of workers being taken out of the workplace, but on government-assisted pay. And the whole COVID-19 regime was extremely expensive.
Okay. Gilbert Doctorow is our next guest who joins us for this part of the QA. He's an independent international affairs analyst. Gilbert Doctorow, welcome. Even before the complications that the UK is experiencing, it was very vulnerable because it was looking at an economy that was not doing well, especially after Brexit. And of course, the trade with other European countries decreased. Some analysts have even stated that the UK never recovered from the 2008 financial crisis. Is that the case? Do the economic problems of the UK go that far back?
United Kingdom, again, as I said, was caught in the middle of these serious challenges that have a continental-wide and European and global impact. And it was in a transition period which left it unprepared to respond adequately to the challenges arising in its relationship, trading relationship with Europe. Because the Brexiteers and the government of Johnson and then his successor have been ideologues and have been inflexible and have sought to achieve the maximum results from their break with Europe at the expense of everyday business, commerce, and welfare of the economy, Britain has suffered from disruptions. The insistence of the British leadership to resolve the questions over trade with Northern Ireland have been had exacerbated relations. The position of Britain with respect to refugees crossing the Channel and to the support that refugees have received in northern France from where they have traveled by boat to UK also has been a sore point and an irritation in relations at the very moment when Britain is very much in need of better trade relations to face the challenges of inflation and disruption of supply chains.
It's time now for the Info News section of the program. This is where we take economic news from around the world and present it to you. Hopefully, the ones that we have picked is of interest to you. First up, we're going to take a look at an issue that is a problem for the EU, and that is spending as a whole. We're taking a look at most EU residents who are unfortunately in a reduction of spending mode, and that's on basic essentials. The percentage is around 71%, of which EU consumers have been forced to change their shopping habits in order to keep food on the table. That is how bad things are turning out for the EU. People are eating in more and buying cheaper food. Reasons are many. The Ukraine conflict, obviously, is one of them. Next up, we go to the U.S. and take a look at the U.S. consumer confidence in terms of Americans in that country. Well, it has taken a hit for the month of October. It has fallen from 102.5 to 107 102.8, or it has fallen to 102.5. The prior month was 107.8 in September. Now, the reasons for that, inflationary pressures are continuing to be a drag on the confidence of Americans and their spending, and this comes at a sensitive time because it's before the holiday season. So we have to wait and see whether the holiday season is enough to stimulate Americans to go out and spend money. Next up, EU sanctions that has occurred. And this is a topic that we picked because it was very interesting, the response that was given by the person that was sanctioned. The sanctioned person is a high-ranking Iranian general. His response, he has mockingly told the EU, who has placed the sanctions on Iran and this Iranian general, he has said to the EU to buy coal with his assets. And the person sanctioned, Major General Mohammad Bagheri. He was sanctioned for allegedly supplying Russia with drones. He has warned Europeans that a difficult winter is ahead. Of course, this is something, an allegation that has not been proven and Iran has denied. Next up, let's take a look at China's economy. Obviously, we have to wait and see how China's economy is going to evolve based on the sensitive situation. But for now, the GDP growth has rebounded at a faster pace for Q3, but the risks loom based on the economic environment. Official data has shown that China's GDP rose 3.9%. This would be for the span of July through September, quarter year on year. Those were the topics that we picked. That's all the time we have for that.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Rishi Sunak, the new prime minister, has a lot on his hands, and how he will bring the UK out of this economic quagmire is not really known. Let's look at some of the challenges that he is facing. One of the main issues that the UK is facing, and it has become more prominent after COVID-19, is labor shortage. The UK workforce has shrunk 1.2% since COVID-19 hit, coming in at number two, as evidenced among advanced economies. In terms of the shrinkage, obviously that's not good news. Now, another reason for the labor shortage is trade overall and the impact of Brexit. The UK trade openness has fallen more sharply than other advanced economies since Brexit. Here, the percentage change in trade in goods and services as a share of the GDP from 1 in 2017 to Q4 in 2021 is seen, and the UK has come in last. Next up, UK productivity. It has also been impacted by two major factors, you guessed it, Brexit and COVID-19 pandemic. The drop that has occurred based on when the referendum on the EU membership took place and, of course, when then COVID-19 hit. After that, the productivity, when it hit, it did not really catch up to the pre-pandemic levels when it began to rise. Now, another major issue is broken supply chains. That has continued to plague not just the UK, but the entire EU, for that matter. Now, one that we picked is the availability of cooking oil. Of course, the Ukraine conflict has also had an impact on a host of items, but the cooking oil is something that is a major concern for the UK in terms of the shortage, and that's based on the supply chain. Now, out of all the G7 countries, the UK has experienced the worst, or should I say, the lowest economic growth. Even though the percentages are very close, but overall, the UK is the lowest. All of them, however, fall below 5%. Now, it may surprise many, but poverty is a major problem in the UK. 14.5 million people, that's right, 14.5 million people of the total UK population are actually in poverty. That's 22% of the population. In terms of the breakdown, 8.1 million to be working age adults, 4.3 million who are children, and 2.1 million are pensioners. That's something that the UK needs to be worried about with this new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. And then rounding off the list is inflation. The UK inflation rate, the highest that it has seen in 40 years. And that's no laughing matter. I mean, the last time we checked the inflation rate, it came at, this is again, is the highest in 40 years. That number is 10.1%, going up through January 2022. And at this point, it has peaked at around 10.1%, and it is projected to get even higher. We just listed some of the challenges that Rishi Sunak will be facing. Let's bring back our guest,